And now, from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting to Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, throughout the nine worlds and beyond, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. You are tuned to the immortal sounds of Radio Free Asgard.
You are tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 198. The Lay of Thrym. When Thor awoke and reached out to grasp his hammer, it was not there. The hurler leapt up. He tousled and tangled his red beard. His hair bristled as he searched for Mjolnir.
"Listen, Loki," said Thor. "No god in Asgard has seen my hammer. No man in Midgard has seen my hammer. It has been stolen."
Then Thor and Loki hurried to Folkvang and into Freya's hall, Sesrumnir. They knew well that if the hammer were not found, it would not be long before the giant stormed Asgard's walls and brought the bright halls of the gods crashing to the earth.
"Will you lend me your falcon skin?" asked Loki, "so that I can search for Thor's hammer?"
"If it were fashioned of silver," cried Freya, "you could use it. I would lend it even if it were spun out of gold."
Then Loki donned the falcon's skin. The feathered dress whirred as he climbed into the moving air and left the world of the gods behind him. He flew until Asgard became no more than a bright haze away to the west. He flew as fast as he could until he at last reached the world of the giants. Thrym, king of the frost giants, felt at ease with the world. He had unteased and combed his horse's manes. He was sitting on a green mound, plaiting gold thread, making collars and leashes for his horrible hounds. When the sky traveler saw Thrym, he swooped down beside him.
"How are things with the gods?" said Thrym. "How are things with the elves? And what brings you to Jotunheim alone?"
"Things are bad for the gods," said Loki. "Things are bad for the elves. Have you stolen Thor's hammer?"
Thrym laughed, and the sound was like the chuckle of broken ice.
"I've hidden Thor's hammer 8 miles deep in the earth. No one is going to touch it unless he brings Freya here to be my bride."
Loki grimaced, and the sound of Thrym's freezing laughter followed him as he climbed again into the sky. The feathered dress whirred. He left the world of the giants behind him and flew as fast as he could, until at last he returned to the world of the gods. Thor was waiting in the courtyard of Bilskirnir, and at once asked the sky traveler,
"What's in your head and what's in your mouth? Real news or mere nuisance?"
The thunder god's eyes blazed, and it was clear he would brook no nonsense.
"Stand here and tell me the truth at once. A sitting man forgets his story as often as not, and a man who lies down first lies again afterwards."
"I bring nuisance and I bring news," said the sly one, the corners of his crooked mouth curling. "Thrym, king of the frost giants, has your hammer. And no one is going to touch it, unless he brings Freya to be his bride."
Then Thor and Loki hurried to Sesrumnir for a second time and found Freya there.
"Well, my beautiful," said Loki, narrowing his eyes, "put on your bridal veil."
"What?" retorted Freya.
"We two must hurry," answered Loki, grinning. "You and I are going to Jotunheim. Thrym, king of the frost giants, has taken a fancy to you."
Freya was so angry that the walls of Sesrumnir shuddered. The gold-studded benches started from the floor. Then Freya snorted. Her face became fiery. Her breasts rose and fell. Her neck muscles bulged. Then suddenly the marvelous necklace of the Breezings burst apart. The link snapped and a shower of precious stones rolled about the hall.
How would it look if I went with you to Jotunheim? Demanded Freya. Everyone would say the same. A whore, just a whore.
Loki raised his eyebrows. Thor sniffed and smirked and shifted from foot to foot and did everything except look Freya in the eye.
Go away, said Freya, both of you.
Then every god headed for Gladsheim, the hall with the silver thatch, to sit in solemn council and discuss how to recover Mjolnir. The goddesses joined them there. The watchman Heimdall had left Himmelsbjorg and the trembling Rainbow Bridge. Like the other Vanir, he could read the future. The white god said,
Let us swaddle Thor.
He paused and looked around.
Swaddle Thor in the bridal veil.
There was a moment of silence and then a howl of laughter from the assembled gods and goddesses. Heimdall waited until the uproar had died down, and then he went on.
Let us repair the necklace of the Breezings and secure it round his pretty neck.
Once again, Gladsheim erupted, and Thor looked across at Heimdall with profound distaste. But the white god was unabashed.
He must be decked as befits any bride. A bunch of jingling keys must hang from his waist, and he must wear a becoming dress, as long a dress as possible.
We mustn't forget to pin well-wrought brooches on his breast. This care for detail delighted the gods and goddesses, and they also saw the force of Heimdall's argument.
And he'll need a charming cap, concluded Heimdall in a sing-song voice. A charming cap to crown it all.
Thor scowled.
You'll all mock me and call me unmanly if I put on a bridal veil, he said.
Then Loki, the son of Laufey, called out insolently.
Silence, Thor, there's no argument. Giants will live in Asgard if we don't retrieve your hammer.
So the gods and goddesses swaddled Thor in a bridal veil. They repaired the necklace of the Breezings and clasped it around his neck. They hung a bunch of jingling keys from his waist, and he wore a becoming dress down to his knees. They pinned well-wrought brooches on his breast, and they crowned it all with a charming cap.
I'll be your maidservant, warbled Loki. We two will hurry to Jotunheim.
The Thunderer's goats were rounded up and driven to Bilskirnir. There they were harnessed and impatiently bucked and wrestled with their halters. Gaping fissures opened in the fells, flames scorched the earth, and Thor, the son of Odin, galloped with Loki to Jotunheim.
She will come! Shouted Thrym in a frenzy. She's coming! Stir up your great stumps! Spread straw on the benches! They're bringing Freya, Njord's daughter from Noatun, to be my bride!
Thrym strode up and down his chilly hall, checking the arrangements. Then he sat on a bench and said to himself,
I've cattle in my stables with horns of gold. I've jet-black oxen, beasts to gladden the heart of any man. I've piles of precious stones and mounds of silver and gold.
Thrym's thoughts evaporated in the cold air and he sighed.
I've had everything I wanted. Everything except Freya.
When the travelers from Asgard arrived at Thrym's hall in the early evening, they were welcomed with great ceremony. The same giant servants who had spread straw on the benches now served up a fine supply of good food and drink. Thrym ushered Thor in his bridal veil to the feasting table. With all the courtesy he could command, he pointed out the fine fare drawn from earth, sea, and air alike in her honor. Then he led his intended bride to one high seat, and himself sat in the other. Loki promptly ensconced himself next to Thor on the other side. Thor felt hungry. He devoured an entire ox, and followed that with 8 salmon. Then he scooped up and scoffed all the delicacies set apart for the women. And to round things off, he downed 3 horns of mead. Thrym watched this feat with growing surprise and anticipation.
Who has ever seen a bride with such hunger, such thirst? He exclaimed. I've never met a woman who took such huge mouthfuls or who drank so much mead.
The subtle bridesmaid sitting at Thor's side took it upon herself to answer Thrym.
Freya has not eaten for these past 8 nights. So wild was her desire for her wedding night.
Thrym leaned forward and peered under the veil. He could not wait to kiss her. The giant king was so startled that he leapt back the whole length of the hall.
Her eyes! He shouted. Why are Freya's eyes so fearsome? They're like burning coals.
The subtle bridesmaid sitting at Thor's side took it upon herself to answer Thrym.
Freya has not slept for these past 8 nights. So wild was her desire for her wedding night.
Now Thrym's luckless sister walked up to the bride and bridesmaid, and she was not half-hearted about asking for a dowry.
If you want my love, she said, and my loyalty, give me the rings of red gold on your fingers.
Bring forth the hammer, called the king of the giants. Bring forward the hammer to hallow the bride. Put Mjolnir between her knees now, so that Var will hear our marriage oath and give us her blessing.
The Thunder God's unsparing heart sang and danced when he saw his hammer. As soon as it was placed between his knees, he snatched it up in his mighty grasp, swept off his veil, and stood revealed as the god Thor, the Hurler. Thrym leapt up from his high seat, and his companions leapt up from their benches. Thor's eyes were as red as his beard. He glared at the company of giants and growled. Then he raised his hammer, took one massive step towards Thrym, and crushed his skull. Thor showed no mercy. He felled all the other giants and giant women at that bridal feast. The hall floor was strewn with a host of bodies. Thrym's luckless sister had dared ask for gold rings, but the iron hammer rang on her skull. And so Thor, the son of Odin, won back his hammer.
I have to admit, I've been looking forward to covering this particular story. And the reason why is because the Lay of Thrym is just pure entertainment. There's no hidden meanings. There's not a lot of clunky metaphors. You know, there's not a lot of the lists of names and things. It's just basically a very straightforward story. Thor's hammer gets stolen. How? We don't really know. You know, it's like the giant snuck into Asgard and stole the hammer. That's really likely. But then they have to go retrieve it. Loki plays his part. And Loki, for his part in this, is a good guy. I mean, he's basically helps the whole recovery of the hammer because, yeah, Loki doesn't want to get overrun by giants either. You know, there's no Odin in the story kind of commanding him what to do, but he does get to kind of prod Freya a little bit, so he does have that mischievous side. Definitely a toned-down Loki. I think that that may reinforce the idea that perhaps Sturluson himself wrote the story, that it's not one of the ancient stories that came down. The difference in tone and style is one thing, and the fact that Sturluson didn't discuss this matchup between Thor and Thrym when discussing other matchups between Thor and other people. So it's quite possible that the story came later, and it may have been, you know, post-Sturluson as well, but it's certainly not one of the earliest stories we have. The only place we get it is in Sturluson's writings. I guess there's really no way that we can ever know for sure whether this was part of the original lore, you know, the ancient oral traditions, or whether this came later. Judging from the differences in the style, though, makes me think that perhaps it did come later and is not part of the original canon. All the same, it's really entertaining, and I really enjoy reading it. One of the interesting things in the story is the mention of the goddess Var. Now, unfortunately, this is one of those characters that we really don't see anywhere else in the sagas or you know, the ancient Norse writings. Var was the goddess of contracts and bindings and that kind of thing. So she would have been a goddess that you consecrated your marriage to. Interesting that they used the hammer of Thor to solemnize the marriage, at least in regards to the bride. Obviously, the phallic imagery is really, really important here. And these are details that we get, valuable details, of the way a Norse ceremony actually worked. I don't know if this is how modern Asatru marriages are performed, but it wouldn't surprise me if this, you know, because this is pretty much a clear step that is taken in the stories that could be translated somehow into the present day. But I really don't know. Maybe one of you Asatruar out there could let me know, because I'm actually interested to hear this. All right, so I didn't want to have just a 15-minute episode this time around, and it just so happens that we have something that we can cover. Now, I had not intended to cover this, but reading over what is ostensibly part zero of the eighth day, I realized this is information that we may want. So I'm going to actually cover part of an issue of Iron Man here. This is not what I intended to cover this week, but because this does tie in with the eighth day and it is relevant to the story, I've decided let's just go ahead and put it here since we kind of have a shortish episode anyway because of our mythology piece. And with that being said, let's just go ahead and move along to our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
And indeed, we are going to be looking at part of Iron Man number 21. So as you know, next week we're going to be covering Iron Man number 22, and that's because that's the next chapter from where we left off last time. But in going over the story, I realized that one of the major characters is introduced in this issue, and the rest of the eighth day just kind of comes right out of this. I guess you could call this the prologue. And because it's relatively short, I figure we have a time to cover it here. Now, the first half of this Iron Man issue is called Burning Need, and it's a story featuring Iron Man and Warbird. For those of you not familiar with Warbird, Warbird is the character, Carol Danvers, was formerly known as Ms. Marvel, and at this point she's wearing her Dave Cockrum designed outfit, actually my favorite of the Ms. Marvel outfits. And you know, I believe that at this point, both she and Iron Man are members of the Avengers. Now, I'm not going to go through this story, and mainly because it's pretty much irrelevant to what we're covering as far as the Thor storyline is concerned. But it just shows us that indeed, during this era of Marvel, they were throwing guest stars into everyone's book. They wanted to foster the sense of the shared universe again, and you know, obviously, guest stars help sell a book too. So we have the story about Iron Man and Warbird, where they are fighting together in a burning factory. And really, the story is mostly told in flashback of the interactions between Tony Stark and Carol Danvers. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but both of these characters have a shared history. Or they have something in common. Both of them were portrayed in the comics as being active alcoholics. So really the story behind the trappings of the adventure tale of rescuing the factory and, you know, coming close to disaster is really about desiring something. And in this case, desiring alcohol. And Tony is trying to guide Warbird away from the booze. And, you know, she's like, well, I don't need you. I don't need anyone. And, you know, it's kind of this typical denial that you find with people who are addicted to things. But, I mean, it's a pretty basic story and nothing special. Artwork is pretty good on it. But, again, it's not really of interest as far as what we're covering. So I'm not going to cover it. However, we do get into part two here of the issue. And this is actually relevant to what we're covering next time. And it all starts out with a opening scene here of Tony Stark taking a helicopter out to a archaeological dig. And we'll just go ahead and we'll do this like we do a normal issue. And we have a scene here where Tony Stark is being interviewed by a TV interviewer. And there's a woman she looks like she's dressed in a, you know, parka and winter clothes, and she's sitting in this airport lobby, apparently waiting for Tony Stark, but she's watching the show with Tony as an interviewee on it. And so we have this female anchor, and she's just like, Tony Stark, he's the cool exec Iron Man calls boss. So, what's next for Tony Stark?
Actually, I'm joining an archaeological dig in Canada's Nunavut Territory, up near the Arctic Circle.
The Arctic?
Normally, we associate you with beaches, blondes, and bikinis.
Well, Diane, everyone needs a change of scenery now and then. And the pilot woman is thinking, must be nice.
And we find out she's sitting at Saskatoon International Airport. And, yeah, this is a commercial. There's a commercial going on, and she's watching this little handheld TV set here. And she's thinking, to have that much freedom, closest I'll ever get to that kind of money is. And she's interrupted by a voice from behind.
Pardon me, could you tell me where I might find McGee Charter Services?
And it turns out it's Tony Stark, and he's actually found her. And she's like,
right here.
I'm Amanda McGee, owner and pilot. Call me Sam. Everyone does.
Sam, I'm Tony Stark. Sorry to be so tardy, but my connecting flight ran a little late.
It happens. Come on, let's get your cargo loaded.
And if that wasn't an innuendo, who knows?
Get this show on the road, she says. And we get this little Raiders of the Lost Ark image here of the airplane flying over a map. And, you know, the map being, of course, of Northern Canada. Looks like they may have photo-referenced this. And Tony, I guess, is riding with her up in the cockpit. And, you know, they're kind of looking down at the ground below, all the wilderness. And he's like, that's Nunavut?
Yeah, our land in Inuit lingo, about 2 million square kilometers of it.
And Tony says, there's such an incredible beauty to the Arctic tundra. So vast. It seems to go on forever. As eternal as the night.
Night's not that long this time of year. Real easy for you to admire. You're not stuck here.
And Tony's like, I beg your pardon?
This is like a vacation for you, isn't it? Well, this is my job. I have to be here. I'm in hock up to my eyeballs. You can turn around and leave the cold behind whenever you want. I can't. They say you're supposed to get used to the cold, but I never have. I'll wear 6 pairs of long johns and 8 pairs of socks, and I still feel it cutting through me.
And we shift scenes slightly, shipping ahead to where they land at the archaeological site. And we see Tony and the pilot, and they're unloading all this cargo out of the plane. And they're being met by Dr. Vernon Mann. And he's like,
Mr. Stark?
Yes. I'm Dr. J. Vernon Mann of the Gideon Museum of Antiquities. So good to have you with us.
Happy to be here, Doctor. I understand you've made quite a find.
I should say so. Shall we have a look?
If this jalopy has a decent heater, I'm there, says the pilot.
It all started when a geological survey team investigating seismic activity in the area happened upon that fissure. The bottom is over 200 feet down. That's where we made our discovery. And they're driving next to this big, huge canyon sort of thing in the ice. And they've carved a road down inside, as they do in Canada, apparently. It's like something out of Ice Road Truckers or something, anyway. And they're driving this truck down into the ground down this ramp.
Initially, our descent was restricted to cable, crane, and pulley systems. We were most fortunate in getting funding to carve this tunnel down to the site.
An impressive bit of engineering in itself, Doctor, says Stark.
Ah, but there is nothing in comparison to what's below. And Stark sees something and says, good Lord!
And then we get the letters page and some ads. And then we get the credits. The 8th Day Prologue. Strange Things Done in the Midnight Sun. Kurt Busiek was the co-plotter. Roger Stern was the co-plotter and he did the script. Tom Grummet was the penciler. Art Thiebert was the inker. Steve Olif was the colorist. Comic Craft did the letters. Bobby Chase was the editor. And Bob Harras was the editor-in-chief. I never realized that Bobby Chase was actually one of the comic editors. I know that she edited Pizzazz Magazine, which was a weird kids magazine from the mid-70s that Marvel did. It was kind of their answer to Bananas and Dynamite and that kind of thing that Scholastic was putting out. Anyway, so there's this giant temple thing here, and there's a big, huge double door, and it's all beautifully rendered here. And people are getting out of the truck.
There's our find, eh? The Temple of Balthak, buried under the ice for countless centuries.
You're the world traveler. You ever see anything like this? Says the pilot.
No, And we hear a voice here.
Good to see you again, Stark. Magnificent, isn't it?
And he turns around, and there's a kind of dwarf guy standing there. And we find out this is Abner Little. Now, those of you who aren't familiar with Abner Little, this is a Jack Kirby character. And he came out of the Black Panther comic that Jack Kirby did in 1976. Just the weirdest series. I mean, it was being done at the same time as Devil Dinosaur, and kind of after his first bloom of titles that he did at Marvel after coming back. And this guy basically is a dwarf who hunts for treasure. So he's like Indiana Jones, except like a foot tall. And it's like, and Stark is like, Abner Little, what the devil are you doing here?
Just providing a little oversight. I like to keep watch over my investments.
Your investments? I was hired by the museum.
Yes, a recent acquisition of mine.
And the doctor's like, is there a problem? Only a misrepresentation, says Stark. I recently turned down an offer from Mr. Little here. And apparently this goes back to issue 18, but we're not interested in that, really. I assure you, sir, this is a legitimate dig. I don't doubt you, doctor. I just don't like being tricked.
Stark, please, we need your technical expertise.
And the the caption says, he sings his praises, and all the while I remember stories T'Challa told me about me, about the misadventures Little had gotten into. I'm crazy for doing this, but... And Stark is like, it is an interesting challenge, and I am already here. And we see that this team is kind of looking at the temple, trying to figure out how to get in. And the caption says, it soon becomes clear enough that this temple will be a harder nut to crack than King Hatop's tomb. We don't want to drill or blast without knowing where we're going, but the density of the great doors defies my fluoroscopes. I steal a little downtime at day's end to buzz the camp as Iron Man. I want them to see my bodyguard in the area to discourage Mr. Little from planning any more shenanigans. And we shift scenes again. It's day two. And so the whole team is kind of sitting around, not really a campfire, but they're just kind of sitting around drinking coffee from the looks of it. And the scientist dude saying, the runic carvings on the door resemble those found in the ruins of another temple buried in Korea. And I believe I'm on the verge of translating them. And one of the other scientist guys is like, knew you could, Java.
Java?
It's a nickname I've acquired from my initials and my love of good coffee. Java man, says Stark. Archaeologist humor, eh? And the pilot woman is like, she's thinking to herself, scientists, they're like big kids playing in the dirt. If Stark wasn't paying a healthy per diem, I'd be out of here so fast. And we shift ahead again to the next day. And they're still trying to penetrate the walls, trying to find out what's behind these doors. And the pilot lady is sitting next to a space heater, like really close to the heater. And she's like thinking to herself, how can they stand to work in shirt sleeves? It may be warmer down here than on the surface, but this is still no day at the beach. And Stark is saying, interesting. There are indications of a small portal here at the base.
What? You found a dog door?
For an awfully big dog, Sam. If I could find the latch. And all of a sudden there's this noise, like a voom noise, and everyone's turning around. And it turns out to be this weird hovercraft sort of thing, like a jet helicopter kind of floating spacecraft thing. It's not really a helicopter. It's not really an airplane. It's just kind of this weird Kirby machine sort of thing. And it comes down and shooting all these like laser beams around with a voo, 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 sending everybody running. And Little picks up a gun. He's firing back at that. And he's like,
brigands, saboteurs, stop them. Keep them away from the temple at all costs.
And Sam is like, since when did this turn into Star Wars?
I don't know, says Stark. Find cover. Gotta end this before someone gets hurt, he's thinking.
And we see him finding his special container here of Iron Man armor. And seconds later, we have Iron Man flying in and confronting this spacecraft airplane sort of thing. And Iron Man's like, cease fire! and there's no response. So Iron Man sets up a electromagnetic pulse, and that succeeds in causing this vehicle thing to crash to the ground. Abner Little's running forward. He says,
"Well done, Iron Man. I knew I could count on Stark to provide us with extra firepower."
And we have a couple of very Kirby-esque people coming out of this. One guy looks like Count Nefaria, if you remember him. He's just wearing a white jumpsuit and a blue cape. Very Phantom Stranger. He stole the Phantom Stranger's cape, basically. And then the other person is a woman who looks like a cross between Storm from the X-Men and Big Barda. Very, very much in the Jack Kirby style, as Little is himself. He's doing a really good job here of drawing some of the characters in a very Jack Kirby style, and other characters are more in Grummet style. So I kind of like the way he does this here.
"Zorba, Sanda, I should flay you where you stand," says Little.
And Iron Man has grabbed his gun away, and he's like,
"Unhand me, sir."
"We've had enough mayhem for one day," says Iron Man. "You know these people."
"I am Count Andrea Zorba, Iron Man, and this is the Princess Zanda."
"There has been a terrible misunderstanding," says Zanda.
"Misunderstanding? You were firing on these people."
"We meant but to disperse them, so that none would be harmed by our landing."
And Iron Man's thinking to himself, Zorba tried to hire Stark Solutions before Little did. What's his real game? And Sam is hiding behind some crates there, and she's thinking,
figures that Stark would call in his hired muscle when things started flying. Speaking of Stark, I wonder where he's hiding. Hello?
And she notices that this little door, the dog door that we talked about earlier, is open, and there's this big glow coming out of it. And we cut back to Iron Man, who's talking to Zorba and Zanda.
"A radio message would have been safer."
"Bah," says Little. "They'll stop at nothing to seize what's rightfully mine."
"Iron Man, the Count and I, like Mr. Little, are of the Council of Antiquarians. We merely wish to help Abner in his quest."
And all of a sudden, Java Man comes running up, and he's like, "Mr. Stark, where's Mr. Stark?"
"I moved him to a safe place. What's up?"
"Something phenomenal," says the professor. "Amid all the confusion, I sought shelter by the base of the temple, and accidentally triggered a secret panel, opening a small passageway to the interior. I was sorely tempted to forge on ahead. Runes just inside confirmed what those on the outside had merely suggested."
"Yes, yes, and what is that?" says Little.
And we shift to the inside of the temple, and we see Sam in there going towards the glowing light.
"If everyone's so hot to get in here, this place must hold something pretty valuable. Maybe even something that could finally get me out of debt."
And she comes across a room with a sort of short pyramid kind of thing, like a big brazier, really. And it's got all this fire shooting out of the top. And we get a little narration here. And the narration is actually what Java Man is telling Stark and etc. outside.
"If my translation is correct, the temple was built to house a source of incredible power, a legendary brazier of Balthek. And if there's anything to the legends, that power may burn as brightly today as it did when it was placed there millennium ago, eh?"
And Sam is getting closer to the fire. And it's this big fire just shooting up out of the rock. And she's thinking to herself,
"The warmth feels so good. I must have it. Must have it."
And we then shift to the outside. And the doors of the temple fly open with a thoom. And sends rocks and stuff scattering. And everyone's like, "Good Lord." And kind of scattering. And there's light pouring out. And Iron Man takes off. He's like,
"Here, keep everybody back until I've had a chance to check this out."
And he throws a gun device down to Dr. Man and goes taking off into the temple. And we get a little narration here from Stark.
"My helmet's eye shields darken automatically as I streak down the winding corridors. There's a blinding, dazzling light that seems to come from all around me, but especially from dead ahead."
And he lands in the room where the brazier is, and it's like these lightning bolts come out and strike him with a zocked, and he manages to dodge one, but then he gets hit and falls down with a wonked. There's a figure that we see kind of standing there glowing, and we hear the voice, "Ha! If this the best the world can muster, then 'twill be Inferno who reigns supreme." And we end with a full-page spread here of Iron Man, and he's just laying on the ground, and this Inferno character is towering over him. She obviously has been transformed by the brazier, the power of whatever, and they're trying to make the armor look Kirby-ish, but it doesn't really. It's not very much in a Kirby style, other than a few little touches here and there. But they're going for that kind of look anyway, kind of a cross between Kirby and Ditko, maybe. Maybe this looks more Ditko than Kirby. Either way, she's wearing this kind of weird armor that, you know, kind of in the joint areas you see, like, she's made up of Kirby crack, all that kind of thing. And she's got these two, like, chimneys on either side of her neck, and they're kind of spewing out smoke. And she says, "By the greater glory of Balthak, let the call at last go forth, and when all are chosen, this world shall see the dawning of the eighth day, and it shall tremble." And that's Iron Man number 21, at least the second story in it. And we do have a few things to say about this, which we will say right after this message.
Hey, Kids Comics!
Hey, Michael!
Yeah?
We need to do a new promo.
A new one?
A new one.
Why?
Because we've moved.
Moved?
Moved. We've moved to a new place. We still read comics.
We do. We still talk about comics.
Because you can't do a comic book podcast unless you read and talk about comics, because that's kind of stupid. But now, we have a new episode still available every Thursday, but at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey, Kids Comics!
So remember, Hey, Kids Comics has moved to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Still, every Thursday. That'll do, won't it?
And we are back. So, yeah, so like I said, I wanted to cover this just because it's important to what's coming. It's not necessarily the most vital part of the story, but here we have a major player in this eighth day story that has now arrived on the scene. And because the story was short, and also because we had a short myth as well, I felt that, okay, well, it fits here, and it's important enough that we should find out what's going on. Now, the writing, to be honest, is really not anything all that special. It's a bit cliche. We've kind of seen this all before. I like the fact that they brought these obviously Jack Kirby characters or Jack Kirby-inspired characters into this, because that I just think it's cool. I like the fact they brought Abner Little back, even though, you know, he wasn't my favorite character back in the 70s. And also, the art by Tom Grummett is pretty good. I really liked his stuff over at DC. He drew the Superboy series for quite some time. Was associated with the Superman family of comics over at DC in the 90s, and so to see him working on a Marvel book is kind of refreshing. So next time, of course, we're going to cover the next part of this in Iron Man number 22, which is actually the proper continuation of the story. As if that weren't all confusing enough, then we're doing these little bits out of sequence. I'm sorry about that. I know, it's kind of a pain in the ass. Anyhow, that's about it. So with that, I think it's time to wrap up the show for now. Thanks very much, folks, for listening once again. And of course, if you want to join us on Facebook, please feel free to do so. And of course, you can email us too. The email address is radiofreeasgard@gmail.com. And with that, I am climbing into my solar-powered... No, I'm sorry. And with that, I'm climbing into my transistor-powered armor. I'm going back to my office with my briefcase and my cocktail and pepper pots. And we'll see you next time here on Radio Free Asgard. You have been listening to Radio Free Asgard, a production of Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all associated characters are mostly copyright Marvel Comics. The stories presented are done so for educational, review, and entertainment purposes only. No ownership is implied. The silly voices, however, well, they're all me. Musical selections from Eden, the Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, are copyright Mots Vent and are used with permission. If you like what you've heard on the show, we hope you'll leave us a review on iTunes, tell your friends, or even join our Facebook group. We really love hearing from our listeners, and we appreciate all of your support. Thanks once again very much for listening to Radio Free Asgard.